Sorry for the musical chairs. We've got logistical challenges this week as we've got judges coming in and out. Welcome to the first day of this week in Montgomery. I'll give my little speech that I typically give. Some of you have heard it before. Most importantly, please know that we've read your materials. So we've read the briefs and the cases you've cited, done some of our own independent research. Most importantly, you don't need to waste your own precious time with a bunch of factual and procedural ramp up. Just get to it. Limited time before us, and so use it wisely. Second, traffic light system, you'll understand intuitively, I think. Green is go, yellow is slow, red is stop. I, as some of you may know, am not great at cutting people off in the middle of a sentence, and so just try to read my body language and know that your time is up. When you see the red light, please just respect the court's time and give it back. If we're asking questions of you, feel free to keep answering them. But when you have concluded, go ahead and sit down. All right, so we've got three cases. Start with Marbury versus the warden, 24-13513. We've got Ms. Warnock here for the appellant. Mr. Seiss here, is that correct pronunciation?
Cease.
For the appellee. Ms. Warnock, you've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Very well. Proceed when ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Jill Warnock on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Mitchell Marbury. This case concerns one question: whether the record would allow a reasonable jury to find that inmate-on-inmate violence at St. Clair Correctional Facility poses a substantial risk of serious harm to Mr. Marbury. The answer is yes. To satisfy this inquiry, the court asks whether violence was the norm or something close to it. The record is replete with facts that support such a showing. For example, when Mr. Marbury warned Warden Specs that he feared retaliation after a prior stabbing, Warden Specs told him to get a knife or pay a gang for protection. A jury could reasonably understand that response as confirmation that violence at St. Clair was not atypical. It was expected.
Well, the district court knew what incidents took place, but it didn't have the total prison population, did it? And so how does the court place those statistics in the context if it doesn't have the total prison population?
Sure, Your Honor. As you know, Mr. Marbury was proceeding pro se below. He did not have in his possession the number of inmates at St. Clair. That was not in the incident reports that the defendants submitted. Mr. Marbury's access to the internet is non-existent as far as I'm aware, and the district court could have fairly easily taken judicial notice. It's publicly available. It took me just a minute to find it. And if the district court had considered it so essential, such as to end Mr. Marbury's case, I think that it should have taken judicial
notice. The total prison population is nowhere in the record. Is it in any of the incident reports?
It is not, Your Honor.
It's not?
It is in our briefing, but it was not in the record.
Can I ask you a question about the judicial notice point? So I assume that our review of the district court's refusal to take judicial notice is an abuse of discretion review. But are we entitled to take judicial notice ourselves?
Yes, Your Honor. This court has taken judicial notice of prison incidents in the cases cited in my brief where they were not in the record below. Of course, then it would have to be submitted in the record below to be before the district court.
Got it. Okay.
Why aren't we bound by our decisions in Purcell versus Toombs County and Harrison versus Culver, where we said that inmate-on-inmate violence has to be pervasive? And what we have here, according to the appellee, is just a few isolated incidents. And you only had a few isolated incidents in those cases. So why aren't we bound by our precedent in those two cases that are cited in the briefs?
Your Honor, I don't believe that those two cases are factually on similar to this case. This case, the incident reports have roughly 200 inmate-on-inmate assaults over a two-year period. In Purcell, there were 2 to 3 incidents over a 9-month period, with not many other incidents over a 4-year period. And in Harrison, I think there were 33 attacks over three years. So the numbers here are quite staggering compared to the court's prior cases.
Can I ask you a question? What do we do about, of what relevance, I guess, to your case is Boykins, this district court case? I know it's not binding on us. It's the same facility. It seems pretty similar. But we can't, like, judicially notice the findings in that case on that record. So how does it tie into your case here?
Sure, Your Honor. As you note, Boykins is not before this case, but it is at the same facility over the same period of time. Mr. Boykins was attacked about a month before Mr. Marbury at St. Clair. I think it helps this court kind of put into context why the record and, you know, it helps support the record here, but it also puts into context what the record could have developed and can develop on remand. So Mr. Marbury is a pro se inmate, is subject to the special reports process, such as where, like, discovery is very overseen by the magistrate judge. It's very limited. Boykins was not subject to the special reports process, such that there was intensive discovery, including depositions by the defendants. And that kind of, I would say, explains kind of the factual differences that you'll see in Boykins compared to this record.
Can I ask you one other? So one thing that your adversary says is that, look, this guy was on the L block. And so all the statistics in the world about prison-wide attacks don't do us much good. What kind of numbers do we have about the L block?
Sure. So in the L block specifically, there were 24 incidents. The magistrate judge counted 23, I counted 24, somewhere around that over a two-year period. About half of those involved weapons. But I think I would like to dispel the notion that Mr. Marbury was just sitting in the L block, you know, locked in there safely all day. The record supports that inmates were frequently in unauthorized areas of the prison. Mr. Marbury testifies that inmates who were not supposed to be in the L block moved in there. Mr. Marbury also testifies about incidents that he saw in other areas of the prison. So the inference is taken in Mr. Marbury's favor, you know, support a conclusion that kind of the prison was more porous than I think this, like, segregated, locked in the L block kind of narrative would say.
And in terms of just sheer numbers, you said 23 or 24 attacks. Do we know what the population, so to speak, of the L block is?
The population of the L block is not in the record. It is in the record that it was only partially full. So that's all that's in the record right now.
Okay. I guess that's the concern that we have and that the district court had, is without that total population, you know, there was no opportunity for the court to place these stats that you just articulated in response to Judge Newsom's questions into context.
Sure, Your Honor. I would like to go back to the rule that Mr. Marbury is a pro se inmate, that he does not know the population of the L block. That was something that the defendants would have.
His case was before us once before, wasn't it? And he got discovery, and so why didn't he get that through discovery when it went back down?
Sure, Your Honor. He did ask for some additional information in discovery. He mostly focused on the incident reports because that was the topic that this court prior said that he should have access to. He asked for other, you know, policies and regulations at St. Clair, which could potentially include, you know, when the inmates are transferred, like he was, you know, what the procedure around that was. But discovery was denied onto the security policies at St. Clair that he asked for.
Can I ask you to shift gears a little bit? What about the other side's arguments for alternative bases for affirmance? What do we do with those?
Yes, Your Honor. So I don't think you can affirm on either regarding deliberate indifference. Right now, the record supports that Mr. Marbury had told each of the defendants about his own fear of retaliation, and the incident reports indicate that all the defendants were aware of a substantial number of inmate-on-inmate assaults. As I said, there's been no testimony from the defendants on this, so that's why we ask for remand and further proceedings regarding deliberate indifference. On qualified immunity, I think that we're so, if you know, we go with a substantial risk of serious harm. Here, it's very tied into the merits. Given this court's precedent, including in Marsh and Hale, the defendants would not be entitled to qualified immunity on this record.
Okay. All right.
Just a few more things I'd like to draw the court's attention to. In Mr. Marbury's sworn testimony, he, as I mentioned in my opening, he was told to get a knife or pay a gang for some protection when he asked Warden Specs for protection. He testifies that he has witnessed several stabbing incidents at Sinclair, including one where a supervisor took a knife only to give it back to the inmate he took it from to go stab the inmate he just got into it with. That's a quote from Mr. Marbury's sworn complaint. And the incident report's statistics also support Mr. Marbury's testimony regarding widespread access to weapons. There were at least 48 stabbings in 2016 and 32 in 2017. Nearly 40% of all inmate-on-inmate incidents required hospitalization. So, yes, we believe on this record a reasonable jury could find that St. Clair Correctional Facility posed a substantial risk of serious harm to Mr. Marbury, and we respectfully ask that the court reverse and remand.
Okay, at the risk of stepping on your closing. Sorry about that. Okay. I have four more. Another thing that the state says is, wait, this is a 2017 incident. Why are we looking at 2016 statistics in addition to the 17s?
Yeah, so I think because this is a generalized risk case, not just a particularized risk to Mr. Marbury, the circumstances that St. Clair as a whole are relevant for this court's inquiry. It's also important to keep in mind that Mr. Marbury was at St. Clair in 2016.
But he's kind of had that case, right?
Sure, he's had that case. Kind of, maybe. It's still relevant because, again, it's just the generalized circumstances at St. Clair as a whole. The court ordered that these 2 years for discovery, and so that's kind of why we have the 2016 and 2017.
Got a few seconds left. Do we know from the record why he was moved from Holman to St. Clair and back to, he was moved back and forth? Do we know that from the record?
We do not, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very well. Thank you so much. And you've got 4 minutes remaining rebuttal time. Mr. Cease.
May it please the court. Ben Cease on behalf of the St. Clair officials. This court held in Marbury 1 that Mitchell Marbury failed to establish substantial risk based on general violence at St. Clair for two reasons. First, he failed to provide evidence that put the amount of violence he established in context. And second, he failed to point to evidence of specific features at St. Clair, rendering it particularly violent.
Can I ask you just, I guess, before we get too deep into this case, to comment on St. Clair? St. Clair seems to be the subject of a lot of litigation and a lot of inmates at least surviving threshold determinations, 12B6s and summary judgments. Is there a problem at St. Clair?
Your Honor, we're here to engage with the record in this case about St. Clair. I'm not disputing as a general matter that in the media, in other cases, that St. Clair is a violent prison, but we're dealing with what Mr. Marbury established in this case. And what he established in this case, as to the relevant context, where he was segregated in a three-quarters empty cell block, in L2 block, was only in 2017, since the Holman transferred, one assault. He established one assault. And that's not enough.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, let's talk about this case, okay? He has not just his statistics, but he also has his sworn complaint and his affidavit where he backs up his allegations. He said he witnessed a supervisor break up a fight and give the knife back to the inmate. He alleges that he was hit on the head with a 20-pound dumbbell by another inmate, and that was ignored. He states that inmate safety was ignored. He states that inmates could travel freely among cells without supervision. So he's got more than just the statistics. He's got his own affidavit, and he's got his sworn complaint, and he's got more than a few isolated incidents, which we've held was insufficient in the past. That's a pretty strong record to support that he was subjected to a substantial risk of harm there, isn't it?
I disagree, Your Honor. We're looking at whether the generalized risk of violence at St. Clair posed a substantial risk to Mr. Marbury in his specific context of being locked in L2 block. So yes, he points to isolated incidents in his complaint and his affidavit. The district court found that his testimony related to unauthorized cell block changes was not specific and cannot be credited for purposes of summary judgment. And this court in Caldwell said that only specific evidence can be credited to oppose summary judgment. So the relevant context here is Mr. Marbury's situation in the Holman block at St. Clair. We don't have the population of Holman block in the record. We cannot properly contextualize the assault statistics because we don't have the population.
But even if you don't have the population, is there anything that says that we have to use some sort of proportion of the MA population to make this assessment? Is it not possible just to say that the number of assaults that have been alleged as a raw number is a sufficient amount? Because we're not talking about one or two. We're talking about a lot of assaults in this case. Why can't we just say that, as a general matter, that's enough, even without the bottom line number to make the proportion assessment?
Because Marbury 1 says that the prison population, the denominator, is necessary context for the court to be able to determine whether there's a dispute of fact, or for the jury to be able to determine whether a substantial risk exists.
So there's no number, you think, that would be high enough without the denominator to get past summary judgment?
I'm hesitant to say that, Your Honor. I mean, we have general knowledge about the maximum size of a prison. There's some amount of violence in some short enough period of time that I think probably could, but I don't think that's this case, Your Honor. Again, one assault in 2017 in L2 block.
Let me just ask it this way. The question I asked Ms. Warnock, right? So we review for abuse of discretion the district court's decision not to take judicial notice of the total number, but aren't we at liberty to take judicial notice of that number ourselves? And haven't we done that before? We've looked at the FDOC's website, for instance, to determine, I think, the number of prison guards at some facility.
I haven't seen this court doing it for an essential fact that wasn't before the district court. So in Demanchi, the case that Marbury cites, that was for a fact about the number of colonels and I don't believe that factored directly into the court's conclusion. I typically see it in the jurisdiction context where judicially noticing something, the court has an independent obligation to assess its own jurisdiction. But this court in Chahar versus Bowers, not in our brief, but 120 Fed Third at 212 note 1, explained that it's unusual and disfavored for the court to consider facts that were not before the district court. This is a court of review. The court isn't a fact finder. And so by taking judicial notice of the total prison population, you would be deciding a case different from what the district court.
But doesn't 201 say at any stage of the proceedings?
That's correct. But this court in Johnson versus Lang, an unpublished decision at note 1, was asked to take judicial notice of these exact same prison records, monthly reports from ADOC, and declined to do so for the reason that this court articulated in Chahar. But all that we're talking about here is the total prison population. We're not talking about the prison population of L Block, and that is the real necessary context that's needed to be able to decide whether
are you sure that's not, we're not able to look, I mean, I haven't looked, we haven't looked at these incident reports. Are you sure the total prison population isn't in there?
I cannot say for 100% certainty, Your Honor, but Marbury has not identified the total prison population from those records. The magistrate judge did not, so I don't think so, but I can't say for certain.
And so about L Block, can we really limit any sort of statistical analysis just to L Block and say, well, the case unravels because we don't have the denominator for L Block, when in the sworn affidavit and the verified complaint, which I think we have to take right from for summary judgment purposes, he says, look, whether he's right or wrong, but he says that prisoners were kind of roaming about in and out of L Block or whatever, right? So, I mean, would the number even really cinch it for you?
I don't think that evidence is specific under this court's decision in Caldwell to be taken for purposes of summary judgment. The district court said that he didn't explain who those inmates were, how many times. This was all information that was within his personal knowledge. He didn't need to get discovery.
That sounds to me almost like 9B pleading or something. Like, it sounds like you want him to, or the district court, I shouldn't say you, the district court wanted him to say, like, who and when and which, you know, sort of from where and to where. That sounds like particularity 9B pleading to me.
I don't think it has to be that specific, Your Honor. All he said that there were some unknown amount of inmates, unauthorized inmates, and he just said that they were causing problems. He didn't tell Warden Estes that these inmates were assaulting other inmates. What is Warden Estes supposed to do with that information when he's told that inmates, unauthorized inmates, are there and causing problems? I don't think that's sufficient for him to infer a substantial risk to Marbury from general violence at St. Clair. But also, we're only talking about context here. We haven't talked about specific features whatsoever. And Marbury 1 says that that is a necessary requirement for the jury to be able to find that substantial risk exists. And Marbury didn't point to any specific features below. Now, in his reply brief, he points to two specific features. But in all the court's cases where you found that substantial risks exist based on general violence, there's been significantly more allegations or evidence. We're not talking about just two. We're talking about significantly more. Marsh, there were 12. Lane, 5 or 6. We don't have the same amount of evidence.
Let me ask you this just quickly. You said that he mentioned or points to these features for the first time in his reply brief. I thought really you could read his verified complaint and affidavit to point to some features. I mean, I know you don't want to use that, but you know, if we think that that's valid evidence at summary judgment, he does point to features in that pleading, right?
I think it's certainly correct that there's evidence in the record that this court could infer a specific feature from, but his burden under Rule 56C is to cite to particular parts of the record. Marbury 1 was his case. He knew what his burden was when this court told him that in 2019, but he failed to do that whatsoever. But, Your Honors, if you're concerned about whether there's a constitutional violation here, the easiest path for this court to rule in our favor is on the clearly established prong of qualified immunity. The only method that Marbury has put on offer is the second method, whether there's a broader, clearly established principle that should govern the novel facts of this case. And Marbury is not providing this court with the full text. In Powell versus Snook, a decision from both of your honors, and that's not in our briefs, but 25 Fed 4th 912, you explained that method two requires obvious clarity. It's a rarity. It's not usually, if the plaintiff cannot meet method one, it's usually not met. And
who wrote that? Who wrote that?
Both of your honors. And plaintiffs haven't argued here that this is a situation of obvious clarity. They said fair notice in their brief, and that's not what's sufficient under method two. Also,
now can I ask you a question? Just in terms of kind of judicial modesty, sort of why is it exactly that we should address this issue that the district court never addressed? Like, why should we do that here for the first time?
Well, Your Honor, constitutional avoidance counsels in favor of deciding cases on non-constitutional grounds if possible. And so that's what deciding this on the clearly established prong would do instead of having to wait.
Well, of course, even if we ruled against you on the merits, so to speak, we wouldn't be finding a constitutional violation. We would simply be saying the district court erred in busting this on the first threshold determination of this constitutional issue and then sending it back. We're not really doing or avoiding anything, right? There's a maybe on the first prong here.
I'm not sure how the opinion would look if we lost on the constitutional violation, but I think likely you would be breaking new ground because I think the record in this case is so scant that it wouldn't be consistent with this court's prior decisions where there's been significant evidence or allegations of specific features when all the necessary context has been part of the record. But clearly established law is a pure legal question. That isn't a barrier to affirming on any ground. And beyond not arguing that this is a situation of obvious clarity. Under method two, the broad statement cannot be tied to the particularized facts of the situation. And so in Powell, citing this court's decision in Vineyard versus Wilson, that's what you said. And if you look at the four citations in the reply brief to the cases that they cite for the broad principle, and you go back and look at the full quotes for each of those, in Purcell, the record, in Lane, allegations, Marsh, this case, Hale, a paragraph that talks about the specific facts. None of their citations all of their citations are tied to the particularized facts of the case.
It just seems, QI seems like an odd fit here to me, just because it seems to me, as I've read the cases, we've got like this kind of this dog's breakfast of cases of sort of Marsh and Lane and Purcell, and sort of all of them are kind of all over the place, and this one maybe slots in somewhere in between those cases, and it just seems like an odd thing to say that the law would have you know, sort of that there's much that we can take from it one way or the other.
Well, if Marbury were offering method one, Your Honor, then I think the problem might be more difficult, but he's only offered method two, and I think that the court can easily decide that because he hasn't argued obvious clarity and he hasn't pointed to a broad statement that is not connected to the particularized facts. Marbury also failed to establish the subjective component, and I think the rule language coming out of Your Honor's decision for the en banc court in Wade versus McDade is very favorable to us. The defendant has to know that their own conduct put Marbury at substantial risk, and it's known if they're aware of facts from which an inference can be drawn, and they drew that inference. Everything that the plaintiff points to in their reply brief on the subjective prong is about the awareness, not whether the official drew the awareness. And so that risk under Marbury 1 has to be a strong likelihood of injury, and in McDade, this court said that we can't just focus on the pre-existing risks. We have to focus on the specific actions of the officials. And so what occurred here was Marbury explained his fear of a specific threat related to his he feared retaliation from the 2016 assault stabbing that he suffered at St. Clair. That's what he told Captain Graham. That's what he told Warden Specs. When he told that to Captain Graham, she investigated and determined that his known enemy was at Staten, not at St. Clair. And so that information is not enough to make the officials aware that Marbury is at a substantial risk from general violence at St. Clair. That was one specific threat that he told them. Then as to Warden Estes, there is not a dispute in the record that Warden Estes did not receive the letter that Marbury placed in the warden mailbox. The evidence is only that he sent it, not that he received it. It requires an inference to create a dispute there, and Marbury is only entitled to reasonable inferences. It's not a reasonable inference for this court to assume receipt based on sending when there's no evidence in the record about how the prison mail system works. And that's what this court said in its unpublished decision in Green versus Hooks. And it's also consistent with published decisions from this court. In Rodriguez, at page 619, there is a discussion about a specific complaint that was sent, and the defendant said, I didn't receive it. And the way the court was able to find a dispute of fact there was because there was testimony that he would usually receive those complaints. There's no such testimony like that in this case. All we have is he sent it and unrebutted evidence that he didn't receive it. Your Honors, any of these four reasons, no context, no specific features, no subjective component, and no clearly established law, each warrant affirming the district court's grant of summary judgment. Thank you.
Yeah, very well. Stuck the landing at 000. Well done.
I got lucky.
All right, Ms. Warnock, you've got 4 minutes remaining.
Three quick points, Your Honors. So first, Marbury 1 could not have been more different in terms of the record. There, all the court had was Mr. Marbury's sworn allegations that he had witnessed 15 stabbings during his time at St. Clair. The court didn't say that population was necessary, but it said that Mr. Marbury's testimony standing alone didn't have enough information and that there was nothing else in the record to put that in the context. And in pointing to examples of what could be used as context, such as the population, where the assaults occurred, and over what period of time he had witnessed the assaults. In other cases that this court has found a substantial risk of serious harm, the court has done so without a denominator, like in Marsh and Hale. My second point, my colleague said that Mr. Marbury was, quote, locked in L Block, as I explained during my opening. That does not tell the full picture. There was unauthorized movements of prisoners throughout St. Clair. He made a specific allegation regarding such unauthorized assault. And his affidavit, which is Doc 52, he says that the inmate in the cell next to him reported that he had been attacked when an inmate from another block was allowed into L Block and threatened him with a large knife and assaulted him. We talked about Boykins, and as you said, Your Honor, you can't, you know, take judicial notice of that. But testimony from Warden Estes in that case, he said that he believed around 50% of inmate-on-inmate assaults occurred when a prisoner was in a place where they were not supposed to be. My last point regarding qualified immunity, I don't think we have locked ourselves into bucket one or bucket two. I think those can bleed into each other. And this court in Marsh denied qualified immunity for the prison officials on a record that was substantially less developed than this and did not have the allegations of 200 inmate on inmate assaults over a 2-year period of time. Thank you.
Okay, very well. And Ms. Warnock, we note for the record that you were court appointed. We certainly appreciate your service to your client and to the court. Thank you. Okay, that